Head and neck radiation and chest radiation have a much higher than normal incidence of thyroid cancer, children in particular. People have been exposed to radiation via Chernobyl, and now we get to Fukushima, must be watched very carefully. What we're seeing amongst the Fukushima children is of 100,000 of them, 42% have thyroid lesions by ultrasound, either cysts or nodules. And you can see within a cyst, a nodule can develop, which could be malignant. And with a nodule, which is a solid collection of cells, it could be malignant. And what he was really saying, Marek was saying, was that these children should have what's called a fine needle biopsy. You stick a very fine needle into the lesion, pull out some cells, and then look under the microscope to see if they're malignant. Now, in Japan, they're only following children with large nodules and some abnormal cysts, I can't remember which. But as he indicated, small nodules can be malignant. And he also indicated it's very important to do biopsies on all of them, and that is not happening in the Fukushima population. Children were smaller than some estimate of nodules. I can't remember, Yuri, what size is it? 5 millimetres, which is half a centimetre, so quite big. Children with 5 millimetres or less nodules are not followed up until 2 years where they get another ultrasound, yeah, which isn't good enough. So from that discussion, you can see that it is imperative. It's very rare to see abnormalities in childhood thyroids, number one. Number two, when you do, and you know these children have been exposed to probably high levels of radioactive iodine and a cesium, which is what Stephen pointed out, goes through the thyroid, they should be meticulously followed up. Already three have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer and have had thyroidectomies. Seven are suspected of cancer. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because what I would say is that we didn't start to see thyroid cancers, and you saw it on the graph, for 5 years post-Chernobyl in Poznan, which was quite close to Chernobyl, and they got a high fallout. So these children are only 2 years post-accident. And it would indicate to me, I think, that they got a really high dose of radiation. And that would indicate to me other things, that it's not just thyroid cancer that is caused by radioactive elements. And there are many, many radioactive elements in the release from Fukushima, including strontium-90 and the xenon, which can cause lung cancer, and others, that it bodes ill for the prognosis of these children, because we know that every cancer can be caused by radiation. Every single cancer can be induced by radiation exposure. And these children are also eating radioactive food. And we heard that 10 million people are still in areas where they were evacuated around Chernobyl, but they still live there in Japan, many of whom are children. So it was important to see what a pediatric thyroid specialist analysed from... he didn't analyse the Fukushima ultrasounds, which I was hoping he would, but you got from what he said that we need to, they need to be doing much more in Japan. I don't know what's going to happen to those children, but it's really quite a serious situation. And I spoke to huge audiences of parents when I went to Japan recently, and they're terribly distressed. A, because they're not really told what the ultrasound means, and B, no one really has explained to them what it means, and C, they're not being followed up properly, they feel. And, of course, we're going to see much more in the future. So that's why it was important for Dr. Nidzella to make that presentation, and you can also look it up. This won't be in the record. It's been live streamed, but he specifically requested that his presentation should not be recorded and put on YouTube and the like. Now, I'd like to introduce Dr. David Brenner. Where is he? There he is, come on. Dr. David Brenner is from the Centre for Radiological Research at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University, and his title is Living with Uncertainty About Low-Dose Radiation Risks.
Well, good evening. Let's see. Well, while we're getting the slides organized, let me say my thank yous to Helen for this is not my talk. Yeah, let me give my thanks to Helen for organizing this very interesting meeting. That's the one. Thank you. So my theme is going to be the fact that we really don't know everything we would like to know about the human effects of low doses of radiation. So I'll try and indicate the sorts of things that we do know roughly and the sorts of things that we really don't know. So what are the main effects associated with exposure to low doses of ionizing radiation? Well, they're threefold. There are others, but these are the big three. Radiation-induced cancer, teratogenic effects, that's effects on the developing embryo and fetus, and hereditary effects on future generations. As I say, they're not the only ones. We now know that there are certainly some cardiac effects at low doses. But these dominate. So, and of these, radiation-induced cancer dominates. So that's what I'm going to talk about primarily. So what do we know about the cancer risks associated with low doses of ionizing radiation? Well, most of what we know still comes from the survivors at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there are very good reasons for that. First of all, sadly, it was a very large exposed population. But perhaps, well, that's one aspect. The other aspect is the large numbers of people. So there was a follow-up of more than 100,000 individuals. And the other aspect is the follow-up was for a very long time. So the follow-up was, the explosions were in 1945, and here we are almost six decades on from that. And if you are going to understand the carcinogenic effects of low doses of radiation, you do have to follow up for many, many decades. A study where the follow-up is a decade, shall we say, is not that much use, because you're really not going to get the full picture at all of what's actually happening. So this is a little map of Hiroshima, the epicenter. And somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 yards away from the epicenter, people were exposed, but not exposed to high doses. They were exposed to low doses. So, of course, here at the ground zero, the doses were extremely high, and the people there perished, sadly. In this region, not very many people perished, if any. But they got a fairly low dose. So there's a population of people exposed to low doses that we can actually study. And we can study it because this is a very well-characterized population. As you know, people in Japan are much less mobile than people, for example, in this country. So it is possible to follow a population for many decades. So here are some numbers, actually, from just that subpopulation of people between 2,000 and 3,000 yards, who got relatively low doses in the dose range, 5 to 100 millisieverts. And I will say, this is still much higher than the doses that, by and large, we're concerned about at Fukushima. But this is the dose range where we can actually draw some conclusions. So here's the population who got this range of doses, just this range of doses now. This is data 58 to 98, so it's 40 years of follow-up. Total number of solid cancers observed, 4,400. Total number that you would expect from a control population, that's a population which didn't have the radiation exposure, or roughly about 4,300. So the difference here is 80. So there's a couple of conclusions to be drawn about that 80 number, that difference. The first is it's statistically significant. Because the study was of such a large number of people, you can actually see a statistically significant increase in cancer risk, which is clearly due to the radiation exposure. And the reason that you can see that is because the population is large and that it was followed for many decades. The population had been smaller, or the follow-up had been for a shorter period of time, you wouldn't have been able to see this. So this 80 number is statistically significant. On the other hand, it's clear it's not a huge number. I mean, this is the total number of cancers here, and this is the radiation-induced cancer level. So what we learn from this is that, yes, low doses of radiation absolutely do cause cancer, but the risks are low. The individual risks are small. The individual risks are not large from radiation. Oh, right. Yeah, there it is. Small but statistically significant increase in risk. So if we could do that study in that particular dose range, so how come, well, if we really are interested in even lower doses, why can't you do the study, an epidemiological study, at even lower doses? Well, the reason is unfortunately that 40% of any little more than 40% of any population will get cancer anyway, and 4 out of 10 people in this room are going to get cancer. So as you go to lower and lower doses, what happens is that you're looking for very small increases in risk over and above that 40% cancer background. And to do that, you need larger and larger populations to see that tiny increase in risk over this huge background. And you end up not being able to do it because you simply don't have enough people in your study to be able to look at an even lower risk. And the result of that is that as you go down to lower and lower doses and do epidemiological studies, the results become harder and harder to interpret. So this is a low dose, or these are 3 low dose epidemiological studies. So these are studies of radiologists who, not so much now, but in times past, got some radiation exposure during their professional careers. So that was a good topic to study. So they were compared with physicians in other areas, not radiologists. So the relative risk means the relative risk relative to other physicians. So a relative risk of 1 would mean that the radiologists had exactly the same risk as other physicians. So here are the 3 big studies out in the literature. So here's the first one, showing a statistically significant increase in risk in the radiologists. Here's the second one, showing a statistically significant decrease in risk in the radiologists. And here's the third one, showing no difference at all. So you can get really whatever result you want out of these 3 studies. And it is actually interesting to see which papers quote which of these three papers. But the point I want to make here is that because you're in the noise, because you're at very low doses, it becomes increasingly hard to do epidemiological studies at lower and lower doses. And at some point, it becomes actually impossible as the dose goes down and down and down. And that absolutely isn't to say the risks are not real. It just means that using an epidemiological study to quantitate those risks becomes impossible. So let me illustrate this best I can with a little cartoon. So this is what we want to know. So this is a graph of radiation-induced cancer risk against radiation dose. So imagine we have a few data points. Perhaps these are data points from Hiroshima and Nagasaki or some other population exposed. So we have some data points here with some uncertainties associated with them. But we really want to know, what are the risks down here? We want to, so we need somehow to extrapolate the risks from up here to down here, which is really what we want to know about, because this is the dose range of relevance to Fukushima, for example. So what are you going to do? Well, you could put a straight line through the graph. So here's zero dose, zero radiation-induced cancer risk. So this line is consistent with the data and goes through the origin here. So that's one possible thing you could do. You could do this. You could have a line which goes like this to the origin and then goes along here. And that would say that there is a dose below which the risk is actually zero. So there's a risk up to this dose, and then at lower doses the risk is zero. Still consistent with the data that we have. You could even put a curve like this through the data, going actually below the line here. The implication being that at low doses there's actually a benefit, a decrease in cancer risk, so-called hormesis. I don't for a moment believe this to be the case, but all of these are consistent with the data. Or you could put a curve like this orange one, which is actually higher than the linear extrapolation. So the uncertainties that we have really relate to this, that how do we extrapolate risks from doses where we can actually do epidemiological studies to doses where we can't? So essentially, we have to use models. We have to use our best understanding of the mechanisms of how radiation-induced cancer actually works. And at least my own view is that the most plausible of these different curves is actually a straight line. There are good, plausible biophysical arguments that the right way to extrapolate risks from doses where you can actually measure them to doses where you can't measure them is the linear extrapolation, the so-called linear no-threshold hypothesis. And a hypothesis is all it is, because we cannot test it down at these low doses. But I think it is a reasonable assumption to make, and the risk estimates that I'll give will be based on a linear extrapolation. But we really don't know whether the true low-dose risks are larger than you get from this extrapolation or smaller. But I think we do know that they can't be that much different. The linear extrapolation can't be that wrong, because we would have seen effects in other exposed populations, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example, at lower doses, if the risks had been, for example, a lot greater than the linear extrapolation would suggest. So what's the implication of a straight line relationship between radiation dose and risk? Well, the implication is that as you lower the dose, you proportionately lower the risk. So if you halve the dose, you halve the cancer risk. If you halve the dose again, you halve the cancer risk again. But there's no dose then where the cancer risk actually becomes zero. It's just it becomes lower, smaller and smaller and smaller as the radiation dose becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And most of the agencies in different countries make this assumption, and I think it is a reasonable one. But using that type of model, that linear extrapolation, does raise the issue, which I want to emphasize today, of individual risks versus population risks. And I think this is central to understanding what the significance of large populations being exposed to low doses. So I'm just going to give a hypothetical example here. So suppose there is some activity, radiation exposure maybe, could be something else, where the risk of harm to an individual from that activity is shall we say, one in a million, one chance in a million. So I think we'd all agree that one chance in a million is tiny. That's a very small individual risk. So if I was doing some activity when my risk of harm was one in a million, I'm not going to worry about it. Risk is very small. Now, supposing all the people in this room are exposed to that same risk of one in a million, well, the chances of any harm actually coming to anyone in this room from if the risk that everyone had was one in a million would essentially be zero. Nobody would be affected by a 1 in a million risk, because the number of people is small. So the public health consequences of 100 people being exposed to a tiny, tiny risk would be none. There'd be no population risk, no public health consequences. But now suppose we consider the same risk, the same 1 in a million risk, but now, shall we say, I'm making up numbers here, 100 million people are exposed to the same activity. Now we know for certain that some of those 100 million people will be harmed from that activity, even though the risk was exactly the same as it was when only 100 people were exposed. When a huge number of people are exposed to very small risks, the overall population is that risk multiplied by the number of people. So it would be certain that if the risk was 1 in a million and 100 million people were exposed to that risk, roughly 100 people would end up with harm. So now we have a significant population risk and a significant public health consequence from exactly that same risk. So really what I want you to think about is the difference between individual risks, which can be very small indeed, and nobody's going to worry if they are exposed to a 1 in a million risk, and a population risk, which may or may not be significant from a public health point of view, depending on the number of people exposed. And here's an example of individual risks and population risks. So here's somebody buying a lottery ticket. So this person's individual risk of winning the lottery is extremely small, negligible, you might say. On the other hand, lots and lots of people buy lottery tickets. So somebody ends up winning the lottery. So here's the winner of the lottery. But even though the individual risk was very, very, very small, and negligible, somebody ends up winning the lottery. So again, that's a distinction between an individual risk, very small, and a population risk, somebody actually, in this case, winning the lottery. So with that preamble, let's talk a little bit about the potential human health effects from the radioactive emissions from the nuclear reactor accidents. So bottom line, what are the projected health risks associated with these prolonged small radiation exposures? Well, I'm going to give you some very approximate long-term radiation-related cancer risk estimates. And the numbers I'll give you, you need to think about in the context of what I said about the uncertainties that we have about individual risks at very low doses. Because these doses are are sufficiently low that we don't have any direct evidence of cancer risks. So we do have to extrapolate from risks estimated at higher doses. So these numbers could be a factor of 10 smaller, a factor of 10 larger. That's a sort of uncertainty that I think we have here. So radiation risks among about 1 million Fukushima residents. Individual cancer mortality risk, the risk of dying of radiation-induced cancer from the radiation exposure. Well, roughly about 1 in 2,000, which, depending on your perspective, you can say is a small risk or is a large risk. We actually face risks like that a lot in our lives. The lifetime risk of dying in Japan from a violent crime is about that. Just give one example. So a risk of 1 in 2,000 is certainly not one that you would willingly accept for fun. On the other hand, it's not one generally that would dominate your life and make you very, very, very concerned. So the individual cancer risks here are pretty small. Now let's look at the population risks. So we talked about population risks, and that's taking the individual risks and multiplying it by the number of people exposed. So if we take this 1 in 2,000 and multiply it by about 1 million people, the people who are most exposed in Fukushima, 1 million times 1 in 2,000 is 500. So that's a reasonable estimate of how many individuals will ultimately perish from a radiation-associated cancer. That's a very big number. 500 people dying is calamitous. On the other hand, compare it with the number of people, the mortality from the earthquake and the tsunami, which is 18 or 19,000. In that context, it's somewhat smaller. But really, the point I want to make here is there is a significant population risk, and it's something we absolutely need to be concerned about. On the other hand, the individual risk is very small indeed, and individuals probably shouldn't be so concerned about a risk of 1 in 2,000. And worldwide, basically doing the same sorts of calculations, well, the individual cancer mortality risk worldwide from the radiation exposure from Fukushima is about 1 in 3 million, so it's extremely small indeed. Again, extrapolated from risks that we can measure. Population of the world is 7 billion. If you multiply these two together, you get 2,000. So 2,000 worldwide, 500 maybe in Fukushima. So we are talking about significant population consequences of the Fukushima event. On the other hand, the individual risks are very small indeed. So as we think about the significance of the Fukushima accident, we need to think about it at two different levels, it seems to me. We need to think about it in terms of the population-wide toll of radiation-related cancer that is going to be caused in the future, mostly, by the radiation exposure from Fukushima. And that's likely to be several thousands. So if one starts to think about the risks and benefits of nuclear power, that's the sort of number that we need to think about. So that's a risk of nuclear power. That then you can start a conversation. Well, the benefits of nuclear power are less global warming, maybe, or whatever. But if you think about the population risk, then you can start making some public health questions and policy questions about the future of nuclear power. Now let's talk about the individual radiation-related cancer risks. Well, they're really small. There's pretty well no question that they're really small, and that's because the doses are really very small. And despite that, as Helen mentioned in her preamble, there's a huge amount of anxiety in Japan, as everybody knows, about individual and personal radiation-related risks. So to me, there is an imbalance between the real individual risks and the level of concern that individuals in Japan are having right now about their individual risks. The concern, in my view, is about the population risk, and that doesn't relate to an individual, doesn't relate to my risk of radiation-induced cancer. So I think we've let the population of Japan down somewhat by really confusing these two different ways of looking at risk. The individual risk is small, and so anybody living in Japan or in Fukushima, their individual risks are going to be small. I mean, not zero, but quite comparable with many other risks that that people take in their everyday lives. So to my mind, I think we have a responsibility to be a bit more careful about talking about risks and emphasize that the individual risks are small and the population risks are what we should be concerned about. How can we do that? Well, education, I think, is the way. I think talking to population, to people, and trying to explain what the nature of radiation risks actually are, trying to explain what we know, trying to explain the uncertainties in what we know. So here's one tiny example. So this was in April 2011. So the artists and crew of the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, and also the ABT, the American Ballet Theatre, both had tours of Japan upcoming that summer, in June and July. And naturally, read what's in the papers, there was an awful lot of concern from everybody. Is it a reasonable thing to go? What should we do? So
I in fact went to the, this is actually on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, went and talked for several hours about what radiation is, what are the risks associated with low doses of radiation. Tried to be as candid as I possibly could, tried to express what uncertainties we have and what we don't have. And we had an hour of questions in both cases. But the bottom line is the Metropolitan Opera actually did go to Japan in June 2011. Here they are. Here's the wonderful Diana Damrow. As did the ABT in July of 2011. So my conclusion is that if you are willing to sit down and carefully talk to an audience and explain what we know, what we don't know, what are the issues with low doses of radiation, you can get people to understand what the nature of the risks actually are. The other part of the story, of course, is that the part of the reason that there is such angst in Japan is the incredible skepticism and not unreasonable skepticism regarding the information that people are being told. I'm sure any of you who've been to Japan has seen that there is such disbelief as to what the authorities are saying about what the doses really were. And we sort of do, you know, within limits, we actually do know what the doses really are. So how can we reassure people that the doses are the doses that they got were low, which was the case at Fukushima, except inside the plant, of course. One way would be to provide rapid, individualized, measured radiation doses for every person. If we could actually measure everybody's radiation dose directly, well, you'd achieve a couple of things. First of all, you'd actually be able to identify anybody who really did get high radiation doses. That's clearly important. It can be then monitored, treated. But also to reassure the great majority of people who got very low doses or no doses. There are lots of studies to show that if you actually do a test, people are much more believing of the outcome than they are when some person like me comes on in a white coat and says, don't worry, that doesn't work. But actually doing tests does work. So at Columbia, we've actually developed a very high-throughput biodosimetry tool, and it's based on a finger stick of blood, the same finger stick that diabetics use in the standard test, where we can do very large populations, 30,000 samples a day. So in principle, this is one of the methodologies that one might think of to reassure people that people are not getting very high doses, that there isn't some great conspiracy going on that really got high doses, but they were told to get low doses. One can actually measure the radiation dose directly. So let me conclude. I mean, my theme has been very large populations exposed to very small radiation doses. It's a situation that we have in Fukushima, but it's not unique to Fukushima or Chernobyl. Airport backscatter scanners in airports, it's very much the same story. So I'm sure you've all been through those blue things in the airports and put your hands over your head and stuff. So there, the risks, the radiation risks are actually very low. The doses are very low. But originally, Homeland Security wanted everybody going on an aeroplane to go through one of these detectors. And that's sort of a billion scans a year in this country. So there again, you have a very low radiation dose, very low radiation risk. But if you multiply it by a billion, if they want to do a billion scans, which happily they're not going to do now, you would end up with a population risk. So again, individual risk, very small. Population risk, not necessarily small. So at Fukushima, there is
pretty well no doubt that the individual risks are very small, and we need to do more to inform and reassure the exposed individuals in Fukushima about that. And we need to be prepared for further future events to try and be a bit better about our communications. There's also no doubt that there are going to be potentially significant population risks from the emissions at Fukushima. And we need to do better about quantifying these population risks, because that's really the only way we can have a serious conversation about the societal risks and benefits of nuclear power, is by understanding what the risks actually are in a quantifiable way. And I will close. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, David. Would all the presenters for this afternoon please come up to the podium? Tim? And questions? You stand on the right-hand side of the patient and use their right hand for the fluoroscopy, but they're showing quite a high incidence of left-sided brain tumours. That's just come out. That's number one. Those fluoroscopies produce a high dose, number one.
Yeah, the doses that the physicians receive doing fluoroscopies are really tremendously high.
And so do the patients.
Well, the story for patients is different, because for a patient, there is, from any medical exposure, there's a risk and a benefit. So the risk is the radiation-induced cancer. The benefit is getting the diagnosis right. So the story is very different in a clinic, because you have pretty clear benefits and you have pretty established risks. And it's a matter of balancing the two again. But you're absolutely right that both the patient and the physician in fluoroscopy gets a significant radiation exposure.
And it's also true amongst our colleagues that more than a few, probably cardiological examinations are not absolutely indicated. That's number one. And number two, CT scans give a high dose too. I had two recently. But the second, I've got two other questions, that there's a heterogeneity in the population, as we know, fetuses, children, females and the like, and related to going through those X-ray screens at the airports, fetuses were going through, very young children, and people who are sensitive to radiation, like immunosuppressed people. And the third thing, I didn't quite understand you, because you said it's a low-dose radiation, but I don't understand that from an internal emitter perspective. These people are still eating radioactive food. In fact, it's encouraged that the Fukushima farmers grow the food and people should eat it, because it's good for the farmers. And children are living still in zones that would have been evacuated around Chernobyl. Did you include the effect of internal emitters, which goes specifically to, like, plutonium is iron and goes to bone and liver and the like, and cesium that goes to heart specifically in endocrines. And the dose sometimes is just to a small group of cells that get a high dose, especially for an alpha emitter, and the rest of the body gets nothing. So I don't quite understand how you worked out that these people would be less at risk.
Well, we can make a reasonable estimate of what the radiation dose to the population is. So there have been half a dozen different estimates, as you know, and they'll vary by factors of two or three. So there is certainly an uncertainty in the doses, and that factors into the uncertainties in the risk estimates. I mean, that's one of the factors which will produce
uncertainty in the risks. But we know that the doses are not 10 times higher than estimated. We know it's not that sort of uncertainty. We're talking about uncertainties of factors of 2 and 3.
And the last point I'd make is Dr. Yablokov's work, which was initiated, or the publication, by actually Tim Rousseau, the New York Academy of Sciences, which shows a really large number of people affected from Chernobyl from various diseases. I mean, really large. So I can't quite comprehend your estimate with Fukushima, which a lot of radiation escaped, and Chernobyl, where there was a similarly exposed population.
Well, the story in Chernobyl, I think, and if you look at the risk estimates that are out there in the literature, there are some very low ones. There are some, you know, it's zero, which I'm sure is not true. There are some very high ones indeed, and then there's the middle ground. So the sorts of risk estimates I was talking about really represent the middle ground. That linear hypothesis is very much the middle ground between the folks who say there's no risk at all and the folks who are saying that there's extraordinary risks, which, you know, we just haven't seen.
Thank you. Dr. Mousseau, I would first like to begin by thanking you for doing the research and educating us on the topic of affected wildlife. Since it was the careless mistakes of human beings that compromised their health, what is being done from our end to restore populations in animals and insects where we have seen such declines? I hope the answer isn't nothing.
What is being done?
To restore the populations and make them all better.
Whoa. The approach in Ukraine so far around Chernobyl has been to put a fence around the area and treat it as a basically as a preserve, a reserve. And I think that's a good idea, actually. I think that's a wonderful use of these vast, quite highly contaminated lands. Fukushima, again, there's really an attempt to remediate the arable land. You know, Japan has relatively little flat land. Most of it's in the form of mountains. And so they're not, I think, there's no active management plan for the wildlife that I know of, other than a fence around some parts of Chernobyl.
In other words, you can't alleviate what's happening to the animals and insects in those zones. And as I said, this data could be extrapolated to humans. Dr. Bislar, number one, are there studies in fish showing concentration in certain organs? Number two, can cesium be filtered out of water for drinking? Once in the ocean, can it evaporate again into the atmosphere? The cesium travelled 190 miles by degrees by August the 12th, 2012. How far away is it from the US, and when is it predicted to hit the US?
Probably easiest to go in reverse order. The soluble cesium that's moving in those plumes that we showed you had reached about halfway across the Pacific after 1 year. The Kuroshio itself kind of diverts into two kind of parts, one which is heads towards north, towards Alaska, the other reaches the west coast and heads south. I have not seen any data on the U.S. west coast that it has happened yet. Now, we've seen the debris, right? You've heard about the soccer balls, the things that are blown by the wind. The other complication, so we're getting to the point where that is possible to measure with the techniques in someone like my lab, not with a Geiger counter, but by collecting very large volumes and looking for that fingerprint. But what we haven't seen is, we've seen the debris, we haven't seen the cesium show up as quickly, which fits with these ocean models of currents. And the levels that we're going to see are much, much lower than off Japan. What's happening along the way is it gets mixed out, so that's why the exposure in the ocean tends to be less of an issue than on land, where it stays put at your feet. In the ocean, we have mixing to depth and wide. The atmospheric source of cesium, it really takes very, very high temperatures to get cesium out as a gas, so that's not going to happen. and concentration of fish. The Japanese fisheries data that I've been showing is for tissue for whole fish. I know they have some release on different organs, particularly things like strontium 90. There's some concern about bones and things like that. I'm just not familiar. I can't present it all, but they typically look at what the population is eating because it's a fisheries agency, so they're looking primarily at the meat and the flesh in terms of the cesium and the exposure to that group.
Can it be filtered out of water?
Can it be filtered
cesium.
Out? What they're trying to do on land with some of the cooling waters that are used, the hundreds of metric tons per day, is to put them through things like we heard about zeolites or clays that does selectively extract cesium. Now, it doesn't extract the strontium, and so what we're also finding in those waste streams at the reactor site is instead of being, say, 50 times more cesium than strontium, they're on parity. And so that's a much more difficult, it's not impossible, but not something that they've been actively removing, the strontium 90.
One more question for you, Ken. If we eat seafood from Asia, does that pose a risk to us here? Are there regulations for seafood imports? Are there any studies that illustrate how radioactive exposure is measured in the US? Well, but I went to a sushi restaurant in New York about 6 months ago. Everyone's eating sushi and very nice. And I said, where does the fish come from? And they said, Japan. So could you comment?
I had sushi last night, actually, here in New York. But the fisheries are closed that are the most effective and the types of fish off Japan. So there are checks on that. Certainly they've increased the checks, like the FDA in this country. But still, there can be holes. So I think we really have to hope and ask the questions of the people who are monitoring fisheries in Japan and making sure that fishermen aren't coming into the areas that are closed, that there's a regular monitoring both, you know, here and abroad. And the other point that someone asked me later to be careful with is they have the most strict standard, 100 becquerels per kilogram is 10 times lower than other countries like the U.S. and Canada. So what they're doing to close the fisheries is 10 times sooner than, say, we would close the same fisheries for the same exposure. It's partly because they eat a lot more fish than we do, so there's good reason to have a more strict standard in that population. It's partly because they wanted to convince the public that it was safe to be eating Japanese foods. And that kind of backfired because the fish didn't go down as fast as they expected.
Yeah. Dr. Starr, dozens of articles falsify the ICRP's radiation risk model or show it to be an error. Hundreds of references in Russian language literature show extraordinary effects from radioactivity on genomic instability, genetic effects in plants and fish, which cannot suffer from radiophobia. Why has this enormous body of evidence been ignored by the ICRP, IAEA, and WHO?
There's an interesting movie called, a video called Nuclear Controversies that I think is worthwhile to watch. And in part of the interactions that take place there, they have a former director of the World Health Organization speaking about how the WHO is subordinate to the International Atomic Energy Agency at the United Nations. The IAEA reports to the Security Council, and they don't. Also, there's a contractual relationship between the World Health Organization and the IAEA, so they, WHO has to have their reports essentially okayed by the IAEA. And in the movie, I spoke of the Dr. Vasily Nestorenko, and I believe one of the esteemed guests that's here is Alexei Yablokov was in the conversation. And they were talking, they were asking why, although it was Michael Freneau, I believe, but he was asking, why is the World Health Organization not accepting the reports 9 years of the research from the scientists and doctors of Belarus about the, you know, 100,000 measure whole body counts and 300,000 foodstuffs that have been measured? And what he said was, well, we can't accept that information unless it comes from the government. If you go to the website of Belarus, it's interesting, there really is very little or almost no mention of Chernobyl, except maybe on a subpage, although when you look at the health statistics like the ones I had on today, you'll see a precipitous drop in the life. It's like a 19-year drop in life expectancy from 1986 to around 2000. Since then, it seems to be bumping up, but I'm not sure I believe any government statistics anymore from anybody. I'm getting too cynical. But, you know, so I guess my long answer is just that I think that in terms of the World Health Organization and IEA, there's a problem there, and in terms of who being subordinate to the IEA, and then they also cannot accept the data that I was talking about unless it comes from the government. The government doesn't seem... The same government that puts Yuri Banachevsky in prison for 6 years and tortures him is probably not going to pass his information on to the World Health Organization.
And on that note, Tim, would you like to comment on the fact that the official scientific community here doesn't necessarily accept the Yablokov report and the Russian data? That's number one. Number two, what specific repercussions do the Japanese scientists fear that make them reluctant to attach their names to their research? And number three, do bird droppings help spread radiation to other areas?
Well, let's start with the poop first, eh? You know, it's kind of funny. Actually, about 7 or 8 years ago, I got a grant for about $70,000 from a nonprofit to actually estimate the amount of radiation coming from bird droppings that would be exported out of the Chernobyl zone. It wasn't just the droppings, of course. It was the birds dropping dead, too, which is another issue, because a lot of these birds are quite hot. They carry a sizable body burden. Trying to remember, we just finished a survey of about 1,000 birds over the last 2 years where we actually measured the activities of all these birds. And I can't remember what the hottest bird was off the top of my head. Some of them were pretty hot. And so the models actually predicted significant export of these radionuclides, but just not enough to be really concerned about, given that the stuff's blowing in the wind and moving with the water and everything else. That was the least of our concerns. The book by Alexei Yablokov, there's been, many of you probably have seen Chernobyl consequences for man and the environment with the nice trees. The story behind that photo is kind of interesting. I took that photo a few years ago while we were doing the tracking of mammals in the snow. In the winter time, one February, it was actually the second time we'd tried to get to Ukraine while it was snowing. The first year we got there, and I guess undoubtedly because of global warming, the snow had disappeared the day before we got there. So we ended up in Kyiv drinking vodka for a week, but which you know has its advantages, but
kills the radiation.
It helps with the. It's certainly a good diuretic, and that I think with as far as cesium's concerned is a major help. So a number of years ago we tried to start a project to acquire and translate the Eastern European literature related to Chernobyl, and it proved an impossible task. I tried to get some funding. I couldn't get funding for it. I tried to recruit collaborators and colleagues because most of these publications are actually located in small academic libraries, institute libraries scattered across the countryside. They don't have a central Library of Congress kind of system. And following the collapse of the Soviet Union, most of it just wasn't available. And then along comes a chapter in an email one day from this fellow I'd never met by the name of Alexei Yablokov. And it was a chapter on the environmental effects of Chernobyl, and it basically was a literature review. It was a summary of key findings in very telegraphic form of you know several hundred studies related to environmental effects in Chernobyl. And I told him this was just wonderful. This is exactly what we were looking for. We all know that there's been significant amounts of research from Eastern Europe, but it hadn't been published in an accessible way. It had never been translated, most of it in hard form and buried in libraries, and he'd gone to the trouble to put this all together, and not just for the environmental stuff, but the whole kit and caboodle, and it's a, you know, just a wonderful compilation. It suffers from you know, maybe I shouldn't say this in this audience. It's you know, it's an activist view of the literature, and as you know, many of you, some of you in this room are also scientists. You know that you cannot be perceived as an activist as well, because that by definition biases you, and so we managed to get his book published before the editor actually read it. So the first editor actually loved the book. He lost his job at the New York Academy of Sciences. The next editor who replaced him, are we still broadcasting? I wonder if I should be repeating this.
Go for it, Tim.
The next editor didn't actually read the book until it was just about to hit the stands. And he was quite worried when he actually came around to reading it. But yeah, so the major reaction was motivated, the negative reaction by the scientific community was motivated by the fact that there's a fair bit of activist flavoring to the book. And what I try to tell people is, don't focus on that. Focus on the information that's in this book. This is most of the information is uncolored, unbiased. In any way, it's a simple translation of basically parts of the abstracts or the key findings of this large literature. Very, very useful. We're doing meta-analyses of these results that should be published soon. The basic findings have been repeated many times, and we're seeing them in our studies as well. Now, what was the third
part? Japanese scientists.
Say again?
Japanese scientists. What would happen to them if they were associated?
Yeah, so basically, most of them were afraid that, so the younger ones were afraid that they would never get a job, that if they were associated with any kind of negative reporting, any kind of negative findings, that this would significantly influence their ability to find employment after their postdoctoral positions, current postdoctoral positions ended. The more senior people were braver to begin with, but their bravado lessened over time, and so because there was just so large a backlash in against any kind of suggestion that there might be measurable consequences that were not positive, and so rather than focusing on let's do good science, the best science we can, and let's be brave about reporting it. There's been a lot of self-censorship occurring, I think, in Japan in particular, but undoubtedly elsewhere as well.
Thank you. Dr. Brenner, this morning Andy Gunderson told us that a... What?
Well, if the doses were 10 times higher, the risks would be 10 times higher.
And the mortality estimate would jump from 2,000 to...
The linear model suggests that the risk is linearly related to the dose. So if the dose goes up, the risk goes up, indeed.
So the next question for you, David, is, it seems your numbers are based upon single or one-time exposure to low-dose radiation, but radiation leakage in and around Fukushima is ongoing and is in the food and water supply. Exposure is ongoing. How does this factor into your assessment of cancer risks, if it does at all?
Yeah, the doses that I was using were meant to be lifetime doses, so they took into account the cesium dose over a lifetime. So, taken into account.
Stephen Starr and or Musso, there are three types of ionizing radiation affecting health, but only gamma and beta. You say beta, I say beta. You say tomato, I say tomato. Only gamma and beta are reported, not alpha. as it is emitted by plutonium and americium and neptunium, which has been emitted? Why does any alpha data exist?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question.
Tim?
Come on.
Well, I didn't address alpha radiation today just because, you know, it was cesium, and that's not really what cesium does. But there's a lot of interest in alpha radiation, for among other reasons, from depleted uranium exposure, Gulf War syndrome, and, you know, there's a lot of debate on this, of course. But there's a book by Paul Zimmerman that I think is pretty interesting. It's 789 pages long, and I managed to read a lot of it. And he goes into the discussion of how the dose, alpha particles only go 3 to 5 cell diameters, and they have a pretty high electron volts, the exposure is averaged, it's rather over this tiny cluster of cells, it's over the mass of tissue where the cells reside, and that seems to have a pretty profound dilutional effect. But I don't know, I'm not sure if that's the question that you're asking. Maybe I didn't hear it correctly.
I could comment a little bit from the oceans then, because we've been looking for a lot of the isotopes we saw in Chernobyl, which aren't in the ocean, and that's because I think fundamentally these were two different accidents. Chernobyl was more explosive. Pieces of the core, the uranium and plutonium, were found in Kiev on the streets in larger quantities than happened, say, in Fukushima, where it was largely contained. Yes, hydrogen explosions, we heard there might be some secondary. The amount of plutonium that's been reported, and they've sampled for it in soil, is quite small, hardly detectable from Fukushima, about 10,000 times less than you're seeing from cesium. So relative to Chernobyl, that was a much higher ratio, much more plutonium getting out relative to the gases and the volatiles. So very different experiments. We don't expect as many of these alpha emitters to be from Fukushima. We've looked in the ocean very hard for plutonium. There's no publications yet because it's almost impossible to identify. We think there's I will call this a trace level, a few more atoms or in the units of plutonium that is there that you might isotopically distinguish from the fallout, but it's a much different accident, so a much lower alpha dose in the environment than Chernobyl. And they're not detecting any significant amount of contamination.
Yeah, they found plutonium. They found plutonium. Arnie,
finding plutonium doesn't mean.
Do you want to say where they found the plutonium?
It's nowhere near the explosive force and the quantities we saw from that accident. It's hardly detectable over what's in the drinking water and what's in the soils naturally from the 60s testing. It's a very small number.
I think Bob Alvarez said that it's just not a volatile element. It's a cesium. It's the aerosols and the gases that are most quickly distributed that when the fuel rods rupture, that they're emitted in much larger quantities.
And again, I don't want to say we shouldn't be concerned. That's why we're looking very hard.
Right. Yeah. And then if building 4 goes down, that's a different story. It will be a different story, right? If building 4 collapses. Tim?
Hope it doesn't fall down.
Well, there could be a massive fire. Mm-hmm. So this is for any of you. What are the current contamination and exposure levels in Tokyo? But I think we heard from Arnie this morning about random measurements of soil and house dust, and some of the measurements are high enough so that material should be sent to a radioactive waste dump in America, right?
There was the initial exposure from the noble gases, too, that never gets measured in one of these accidents. They're there for a few days, and people are inhaling these massive doses, it's...
I was just going to say that there are some very good maps now available. So SafeCast, for instance, is a group of folks in Japan who have been putting Geiger counters with with data loggers and driving around the countryside, and there's been a lot of citizen science measurements that have been that are available on the MECS website for you know, again, crude level measurements, but they're certainly very informative, and that certainly guided our initial studies.
Of xenon.
Not for xenon, no. Sorry, nobody has good xenon measurements other than models.
Well, Steve Wing, well, we heard that a lot of xenon got out three times more than Chernobyl, says Arnie. And Steve Wing tomorrow, who's an epidemiologist, will be addressing what the medical effects of xenon release from Three Mile Island were, and they were not zero. Sorry. Yeah, Dr. Brenner. Is the risk based upon Hiroshima is a one-time dose? Well, I think I brought that up, didn't I? What about continuing doses from internal emitters to different organs throughout a lifetime that people continue to ingest? And was there a healthy survivor effect in the Hiroshima data?
Well, let me answer the last bit a little more generally. There are an awful lot of uncertainties associated with the Hiroshima data, and I think the biggest one is actually transferring risks from one population to another, because cancer patterns are very different from one population to another. And the other big one was the controls. So when you do an epidemiological study, you look at the cancer numbers in the population you studied, and then you have to compare it with a control population. So what is the right control population for Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Well, there isn't really an ideal one. The two that have been used are either people who were several miles away from the explosions, but they were actually then in the countryside, and cancer patterns are different, country versus city. The other way to look at it is to look at not in the city people, so people who were residents of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but weren't actually in the city at the time of the atomic bombings. And turns out if you do either of these two approaches, you get sort of the same answer, which gives you a little confidence that the risk estimates in the context of the controls are not so bad. But there are lots of uncertainties, and that's what I was trying to emphasize in my talk.
This is for Tim, but I think any of you can answer it. Is tritium showed to bioaccumulate in sea life? Number one. And number two, please explain genomic instability and bystander effect.
We just happen to have two experts for both those questions. I think the bystander effect is best handled by David here.
I can certainly do the bystander effect. So the bystander effect is the phenomenon whereby if a cell in a tissue is irradiated, and if you know that the next door cell or the next door but one cell is not irradiated, you would not expect that cell to have any biological effects. But in fact, what you see is that they do. You see what's clearly happening is that when a cell is damaged, it sends signals to its neighbors about that damage, and the neighbors can respond with, for example, mutations. So that's what the bystander effect is. What its overall significance is rather unknown at this point. It's a very active subject of research. There's been no demonstration of the bystander effect in carcinogenesis as yet, and that's the big question mark. Is it relevant to radiation carcinogenesis? We do not know at this point.
And genomic progression? Come on.
Genomic instability is supposing you irradiate a group of cells, and then you follow that group of cells as they divide, and they divide again, and they divide again, and they divide again. Well, after some number of divisions, shall we say 10 divisions, all of a sudden you suddenly start to see an increase in mutation rates. And that's associated with, well, there must have been some damage there initially, which was quiet and latent. And then after a pile of divisions, you start to see those effects there. But again, it's been shown in a few systems. It's not been shown for radiation carcinogenesis. But I think most people, myself included, believe that is one of the fundamental mechanisms by which radiation produces cancer. I'm moderately convinced that it's a key mechanism, but we don't understand it so well. I don't think, if that was the dominant mechanism, I don't think it would affect how we extrapolate risks from low doses to very low doses, but remains to be seen, I think.
There's a lot unknown.
There is a lot unknown.
Dr. Ken Bislar, Scripps Institute in San Diego has measured kelp and tuna from Japan to be in the highest historically levels of radioactive cesium. Did you fail to mention this because you believe that these levels are too low?
I'm familiar with one study where Scripps measured iodine isotopes in kelp.
Kelp.
So iodine-131 with the 8-day half-life. Iodine is one of those compounds that in seaweeds is bioaccumulated quite highly, factors of 10,000 or more. So it was known to bioaccumulate, and early on when that isotope was here, you could certainly see it in the seaweeds off of our west coast as well as in high levels off Japan. In fact, that was one of the concerns for dose and exposure was the consumption of seaweed in Japan. As far as the tuna study, that was a group from Stanford and SUNY Stony Brook, and the levels in tuna actually are quite low. What's happening, those animals are feeding off Japan, the bluefin tuna in particular, and carry with them what they fed on, some of the cesium factors, about 100 of concentration factor, not 10,000. And as they swim, I showed you the loss in fish, that's what's happening. They're losing cesium as they move into cleaner waters. So the levels actually were quite low by the time they reached San Diego, in the low numbers, few becquerels per kilogram, 10, nothing near that 100. I tell people, like, if you took tuna and put in a can that was caught off Japan, that would remain. The cesium would remain there until it decayed away. It's in that container. It's not going anywhere. But if you take that fish and let them swim into other waters that are less contaminated, the concentration goes down quite quickly. So those authors actually use this as a kind of a clock, a tool to study the migration of the bluefin tuna and how long it took them to swim from the feeding grounds off Japan to San Diego. So I mentioned it because it wasn't a direct health effect the same way seafood seems to be still off Japan.
Yeah. I've read in a reference somewhere, and I can't remember where, that the Japanese are actually canning very radioactive fish and selling it to developing world countries.
Yeah, that would not be a good idea.
Has anyone heard of that? You have, Stephen?
Yeah, I heard that. I read it in a... It's anecdotal evidence, but they're sending it to Senegal or some of the African countries.
Yeah.
Vietnam. Mm.
Okay. Tim, can you talk about external versus internal radiation, acute versus chronic exposure, susceptibility of organs versus uniform distribution, susceptibility of timing, fetuses, child, U.S. adult, different between modelling, observed often much higher than predicted, therefore predictions based on faulty assumptions. Chernobyl, IAEA said 4,000 died, but the Russian study says over 900,000 deaths.
Yeah, that's a lot to bite on there. where to begin? First of all, I'm not an expert in either of those areas. I think David here is probably a better person to talk about some of the distribution of radionuclides in the body kinds of issues. In terms of the epidemiological models, again, a lot has to do with the assumptions related to the populations that are exposed and the doses that they're getting, and so if you tweak the models one way, you get 9,000. Although Elizabeth Cardis, who originally generated that first model that predicted 9,000, which the Chernobyl Forum, of course, truncated to 5,000 or 4,000. because they didn't consider, they deliberately chose not to consider the populations in the rest of Europe that that had would have unmeasurable consequences. But Elizabeth Cardis, I think, increased her initial, using the same data, increased her changed her model based on changes in dose response up to 16,000, I think. And then there have been, again, a number of other modeling efforts which tweak the models, you know, play with the uncertainties in terms of dose response primarily, and end up with, I think the latest was, the highest I saw was a 1.5 or 150, 1.5 billion, is that right? No, sorry, 1.5 million. And the latest official Ukrainian government prediction based from the health minister, who was something just over 100,000 have died so far from
in Ukraine
alone. So the estimates are all over the map. The truth is, we have not done a good job of tracking these populations, of monitoring these people. I'm not entirely sure what all is going on in Japan, but my impression is that there's not much that is being done, not nearly sufficient is being done to register people and to track their ongoing health. And certainly there's not hardly anything in the way of ecological monitoring going on. But I think I probably missed a few parts of that question.
Probably, but that's okay.
Yeah.
David Brenner, what rates of radiation exposure for Fukushima residents are you basing your extrapolations on? How does it mesh with the experiences of the two service people who were interviewed? How does it mesh with the thyroid study showing more than 40% of the children, well, they're not precancerous nodes, but have nodules and lesions, compared to a control of less than 1%? And then, this is a continuation, you change from talking about getting cancer, which is incidence, to cancer mortality, which is, of course, lower. How does one translate, that is, one cancer death, how many cancers? Don't different cancers have different mortality rates?
Oh, Helen, I've forgotten the beginning of the question, so I'll start at the end. There's a factor of two. It's pretty constant in pretty well every study. Radiation-induced cancer incidence is twice as high as radiation-induced cancer mortality. You've forgotten too. Sorry.
Yeah.
I suppose broadly, I think the question was how are the risk estimates done?
And the thyroid studies, you know, how do you assess showing?
So if the question was how do these estimates relate to things going on in Fukushima,
yeah,
to measurements going on in Fukushima, again, I would say that by far what I consider the gold standard for radiation risk estimation are the survivors at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because the studies were so much better, so much higher quality than were done in Chernobyl, or I think will be done in Fukushima. So my view is that the best way to get reliable risk estimation is to figure out the doses in Fukushima and Chernobyl and apply risk estimates that we got from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's simply too much uncertainty about the epidemiological studies that went on in Chernobyl, I think, to really use them as our best estimate of risks.
But David, isn't it true that there were no internal emitters to which people were exposed to? It was an external dose of gamma, neutron, but virtually no internal emitters to those two populations.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But if you think of yourself as a cell in the body, you don't know whether the radiation exposure you got was from an external source or an internal source. All you know is the radiation exposure which you as a cell received. So there's no reason why you can't estimate risks from internal emitters based on the Hiroshima-Nagasaki data. And again, I would put to you that that's the best way of doing it.
Well, sorry, I'm dominating this and it's nearly time, but I read John Goffman's work, and he was kind of my mentor, and he talked about the hotspot, you know, an alpha particle in the lung, which is always possible, seeing plutonium is particulate. And the surrounding cells get such a high dose in the alpha radiation that they die, but as radiation decreases with the square of the distance, cells remain viable on the periphery, but they get a high dose. The rest of the lung gets nothing, and what the nuclear industry tends to do is average that dose to the tiny volume of cells over both lung fields. Could you comment?
Well, now you're talking about alpha particles, and the alpha particle story is entirely different from the X-ray and gamma ray story that we've been talking about today. And I think we agreed earlier in this conversation that the alpha particle risk at Fukushima was going to be a small player relative to the X-ray and gamma ray risks. But you're absolutely right. The story with alpha particles is entirely different, but I think that's for another day.
And what about beta particles and tritium and carbon 14 and...
Beta particles essentially ultimately are going to deposit their energy in the same way as X-rays. Ultimately, the energy gets deposited via electrons in either way. So there's no fundamental difference between a beta emitter and an X-ray emitter.
Say you eat cesium-contaminated food. We know that cesium from Bandachevsky's work, and I think it's okay, does concentrate specifically in endocrine glands, thyroid, pancreas, cardiac muscle, and I think he did a hell of a lot of work to show that. And therefore, cesium, you can't assume that it is deposited uniformly throughout the muscle tissue, the brain, and all the cells, because it's a potassium analog.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we should end and all go and have a glass of wine. and we welcome you back tomorrow for another absolutely fascinating session where we're going to hear from Dr. Yablokov, who wrote that report, and Vladimir Wotelecki, who's done incredible work on embryology and deformities around Chernobyl, and Dr. Ian Fairley and many others. Thank you.